Chapter 72. Syria. It was amazing how cold the desert could get at night, even after an unseasonably warm day. The rocks, the sand, all of it seemed to have released any stored heat the moment the sun had started to set. Stretching his legs, Harvath checked his phone and noted their position. They were about 100 kilometers from the border with Iraq. As Toman emptied a fuel can into the land cruiser, Maitan kept an eye on the prisoners. They had parted ways with Yusuf and Kobani hours ago. Harvath was relatively confident that the Syrians would be able to make it home without him. Just in case they ran into any problems, he had given them the rest of his cash and his cobalt chronograph. He felt it was the least he could do, especially as he and the Hadids had kept all the weapons and the CIA's Reaper. Having the drone overhead had proved invaluable. Always knowing what lay ahead had made it possible to avoid problems. It had also caused them to take a few wide, extremely circuitous routes to avoid potential enemy engagements. As a result, they had burned a lot of fuel, and the Syrian desert wasn't exactly populated with gas stations.
"That was our last one,"
Toman said as he placed the empty fuel can in the cargo area. Harvath had been keeping track and already knew that.
"There's nothing between us and the border. We should be okay."
Toman smirked.
"Tell that to Mr. Murphy."
Harvath smiled back. The Hadids were good men, tough, smart, and unafraid. Harvath had to hand it to McGee. The agency knew how to judge talent. Whether or not they'd be able to tip the scales in Syria would have to be seen. But one thing was for sure. The Syrian people were incredibly fortunate to have the twin brothers fighting on the side of freedom. Harvath respected the hell out of them. They could have been cooling their heels with their mother in Paris, but they weren't. They were right here, right in the thick of the fight.
"Okay," Harvath said as Toman closed the hatch. "Let's get moving."
Unslinging their AKs, the men climbed back into the SUV. Changing up drivers, Harvath took the wheel. Maitan rode shotgun, and Toman sat in back to watch over Basayev and Raphael, who were on the floor bound and gagged. Harvath plugged his phone back into the cigarette lighter and placed it in the cup holder where he could watch it. Putting the vehicle in gear, he pulled back onto the desert road and continued on toward the border. They had only gone a few hundred meters when Ryan's voice came over his earpiece.
"Norseman, you've got company."
Harvath swung his head quickly from side to side and then turned to look out the rear window.
"I'm not seeing anything. Talk to me."
"Russian drone, coming in hot."
Harvath slammed on the brakes and shouted for the Hadids to get out.
"What about the prisoners?"
Maitan replied. Harvath grabbed his phone and yelled,
"Leave them,"
as he bailed. With the brothers right on his heels, he ran down the steep incline from the road. Gesturing at a thick outcrop of rock 500 meters away, he waved for them to follow.
"Hawk 4, going hot,"
Ryan relayed, using the code name for the CIA's Reaper.
"How much time?"
Harvath shouted as he ran.
"Stand by, Norseman."
"Damn it,"
he cursed.
"How much time?"
Ryan wasn't listening. She was completely focused on the battle unfolding above the desert.
"Russian drone, missile away," she stated clinically.
And then, as if suddenly realizing the target, urged,
"Run, Norseman, run!"
Harvath didn't need to be told twice.
"Hurry,"
he shouted to the Hadids.
"Incoming!"
They tore across the sand, running harder and faster than any of them had ever run in their lives.
"Impact,"
said Ryan,
"in 3, 2, 1.
There was a blinding flash of light and an enormous explosion just as Harvath and the Hadids reached the rocks and the missile from the Russian drone slammed into the land cruiser. Harvath and the brothers dove for the safety of the outcropping as a braided pillar of hot orange flame twisted into the sky and a powerful expulsion of heat, sand, and broken rock raced across the desert with the force of a hurricane. Harvath had made himself as small as possible, protecting as much of his body as he could. The heat from the explosion was so intense, it singed the hair on his arms.
As soon as it had passed, Harvath untucked and rolled up onto his knees, so he could look beyond the rocks to what remained of the SUV. There was only a smoking crater in the road.
"Fuck," he said aloud. "Fuck, fuck, fuck."
Everything was gone. The prisoners, the hard drives, and worst of all, their only means of transportation out of Syria. Above the ringing in his ears, Harvath then heard,
"Russian drone inbound."
Again? What the hell was Langley waiting for, he wondered.
"Hawk 4, locked on," Ryan then stated. "Hawk 4 missile away. Impact in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Harvath had no idea where the drone dogfight was happening. All he could do was look up into the night sky. As he did, he saw a streak of orange flame as Hawk 4 unleashed its air-to-air missile. It was followed seconds later by a brilliant explosion that illuminated the night sky.
"Russian drone destroyed," Ryan reported.
Harvath looked over at Toman and Maitan. Both men had survived. He then asked Ryan,
"What the hell just happened? Why'd the Russians target us?"
"We didn't pick up their drone until it went hot, but you're in the middle of the desert, carrying AKs and headed toward the border. That's enough in their book."
Murphy. Harvath had a bunch of choice words he wanted to utter, especially about the Russians, but now wasn't the time.
"We're not going to make it to the extraction point."
"Roger that. Stand by."
As Ryan reached out to the Joint Special Operations Command for the two stealth helicopters waiting just inside Iraq, Harvath looked again at the Hadids. Toman was smiling.
"What are you smiling at?" he asked, not exactly finding any of this amusing.
Rolling off his stomach, he revealed two pillowcases. Harvath then looked at Maitan, who had the third. He was just about to smile back when he saw motion back by the crater of where their land cruiser used to be. Pulling his pistol, he got to his feet and ran toward it. Halfway there, he saw them. Basayev and Raphael were alive. Somehow, they had managed to flop like fish out of the land cruiser and make it to the embankment. Rolling downhill, they had managed to avoid the blast. Slowing his pace, Harvath reholstered his pistol at the small of his back and smiled. Shaking his head, he uttered just one word,
"Murphy."
Chapter 73. 36 hours later, Amman Damascus Highway, Nasib Border Crossing. The CIA's Reaper and a pair of F-22 Raptors kept Harvath, the Hadids, and their precious cargo covered long enough for the specially modified Sikorsky UH-60 Blackhawks to pick them up and whisk them off to the safety of a covert airbase in Kurdistan. From there, a security team transported Basayev and Raphael via private jet to Malta. Vela was waiting in the hangar when they arrived. He had a new interrogation technique he was looking forward to trying out on them once their physicals were complete. Williams met Harvath and the Hadids as their jet landed in Amman. While they drove into the city, Harvath double-checked that everything he had asked for was in place. They went through the entire list, and when they got to the final item, Williams said, "I had to make a direct appeal to the ambassador on that." Harvath had requested a sniper on the Jordanian side to provide overwatch for what they were about to do.
"And?"
"And it got kicked all the way up to the king."
"King Abdullah of Jordan?" Harvath remarked.
Williams nodded. Though he had never met him, Harvath thought very highly of Abdullah. He had been extensively educated in both the United States and Britain, but even more impressive was his military experience. He had not only been a troop commander in the British Army and a tank commander in Jordan's 91st Armored Brigade, but was a former general and Jordanian Special Forces commander who had also been trained to fly Cobra attack helicopters.
"What did he say?"
"Officially, the king didn't say anything. The conversation never took place."
"And unofficially?" Harvath asked.
"He was extremely moved by your story. You're going to have Jordanian overwatch."
It wasn't Harvath's story. It was Yusuf's and Kabani's. But that didn't matter. All that mattered was that he was going to be able to get them and their families out of Syria. He had promised. As long as they could get to the border, there was a place for them in the United States. The men had more than earned it. Harvath wanted to insert back into Syria to make the journey with all of them, but Yusuf had told him no, it was too risky. He knew the route, and he had the little bit of money and the watch Harvath had given him, plus the money he had saved for his treatments to bribe his way past the checkpoints. Kabani didn't have much money, but he would use what he had to bribe his way through too.
"Just be at the crossing," Yusuf had said. "Promise me."
"I promise," Harvath replied. That had been all that Yusuf had needed to hear. He trusted Harvath. If the American said he would be there, Yusuf knew that insha'Allah he would. Insha'Allah, Murphy, it all came down to powers outside of their hands. Even so, Harvath had no intention of failing the men or their families. Smiling at the unshaven armed thug on the Syrian side of the Nasib border crossing, Harvath held up his laminated press credential along with his phony Canadian passport and said,
"Journalist."
He knew the man remembered him, and judging by the look on his face, he was wondering what he was doing back so soon. Williams, who was sitting in the passenger seat next to Harvath, held up his press credential to the thugs on his side and said,
"Cameraman."
You would have thought someone had just dropped hot coals down their fatigues. Like a bunch of chimpanzees, they began waving their arms and hopping up and down in unison, as several of them yelled for their commander.
"Come on out, motherfucker,"
Harvath whispered beneath his breath. Right on cue, the man stepped out of the crumbling building. He was even uglier than last time. His brown, leathery face that was crisscrossed with scars seemed drawn even tighter. His mustache was so dark, it looked like it was dyed with black paint. With his right hand on the leather holster at his hip, he raised his left hand and gave it one quick jerk. The message was clear: come forward for an inspection. As Harvath inched the windowless van forward, Williams tapped the wall behind his seat with three quick raps. Pulling into the inspection area, Harvath brought the vehicle to a halt, but left it in gear. They had disconnected the brake lights back in Amman. The moment they stopped, they were surrounded. The armed men yelled for them to get out of the car. They began pulling on the door handles, but couldn't get them open. Reaching inside, they tried to activate the locking buttons, but that didn't work either. Instantly, the van looked like a porcupine that had been turned inside out, as countless rifle barrels were shoved through the driver and passenger side windows. The men continued to yell to open up until Harvath raised a thick sealed envelope and moved it back and forth in front of the windshield so that the commander could see it. He barked at his men and they backed off, removing their rifle barrels from the windows. Stepping off the curb, he walked slowly toward the van. He had the haughty air of a petty despot, a man who, given a modicum of power, had decided to abuse it and lord it over all those unlucky enough to cross his path. He was a bully, a shakedown artist, a tyrant. He was the kind of man Harvath abhorred. Sidling up to the van, the commander kept one hand on his holstered pistol. With the other, he played with his oily mustache.
"Money! Money!"
he said, leaning in the window, looking at the envelope sitting in the cup holder.
"Journalist,"
Harvath said, just to be difficult as he pointed at the credential hanging around his neck. Williams, not satisfied to let Harvath have all the fun, echoed him.
"Money!"
the commander snapped in his terrible English.
"Money, now!"
"No money,"
Harvath replied, pointing at the highway.
"Just go."
The commander, unaware that they were screwing with him, was confused. The journalist had waved an envelope at him, and it had been a thick one at that.
"Money,"
he growled, pulling his pistol. It was an old piece of shit Russian Tokarev. They were notorious for discharging accidentally. Anyone who knew anything about guns never carried one with a round chambered. Hell,
Anyone who knew anything about guns didn't carry a Tokarev, period. But that was another story.
We might as well get this over with,
Harvath said, as he reached for the envelope and handed it over. The commander took a step back, and with the Tokarev still in his right hand, ripped open the top of the envelope. By the time he noticed he'd been had, and it was only filled with newspaper, Harvath and Williams had begun shooting. With his left hand, Harvath drew his pistol from the driver's side door pocket. Applying pressure to the trigger, he began firing as soon as he cleared the frame. 5 rounds slammed into the commander. Harvath had zipped him up from the stomach to his face in less than 2 seconds. Before the last shot had even been fired, he had punched the accelerator. As he did, both doors in the cargo area were thrown open, and the Hadids, armed with fully automatic belt-fed weapons, began firing at anything carrying a rifle. Every single thug ran for cover. Harvath pulled a hard left and gave chase. It was an absolute bloodbath. In less than 2 minutes, they had mowed down over 14 men. Bringing the van to a stop back underneath the concrete canopy, Harvath could hear hot brass shell casings hitting the ground as the Hadids kicked them out of the cargo area. He was about to compliment everyone when he saw 6 50-caliber mounted technicals racing at them from a half-demolished building a mile back from the border crossing.
"This isn't good," he said, pointing toward the incoming vehicles.
William smiled. "Get out of the van."
"What?"
"You're going to want to see this," he replied. "Get out of the van." Harvath thought he was insane, but he gave in and hopped out. Williams and the Hadids joined him.
"What the hell are we doing?"
Toman asked.
"Just watch," said Williams.
They stood there, watching, but all Harvath noticed was the vehicles getting closer and closer. They were already in range. In fact, as if they were reading his mind, the gunner in the bed of the lead vehicle began firing. Harvath, Williams, and the Hadids were forced to lunge for cover. Pieces of concrete canopy rained down on top of them.
"What the hell are we doing?" Harvath demanded.
"It's coming! Watch!"
Williams yelled over the gunfire. From back on the Jordanian side of the border, there was what sounded like intense, incredibly loud thunder. Harvath and his team whipped their heads in its direction. As they did, they saw one of the heavily fortified Jordanian traffic gates spring open and a sleek Cobra attack helicopter come flying out. No sooner had it cleared the Jordanian side than its 2 7.62mm minigun pods roared to life and began chewing through the approaching technicals. The Hadids cheered and pumped their fists in the air. With the first 2 vehicles disabled, the others realized they were in trouble and attempted to turn around and head back. That was when the Cobra switched to its 70mm rockets. One after another, the machine gun-mounted pickups and their crews were taken out. It was an incredible thing to watch. As soon as the job was complete, the Cobra disappeared. Harvath was beyond impressed. It had been an absolutely overwhelming show of force, something right up his alley. The Jordanians were amazing. They stood there for several moments before Harvath looked at Williams and said,
"Unbelievable. I hope someone lets King Abdullah know how awesome his pilots are."
Williams smiled back. "No one needs to let him know. That actually was Abdullah." As a Jordanian team raced across to help them sanitize the scene, Harvath took out his phone to call Yusuf, who was waiting with his family and Kabanis 10 kilometers up the highway. The border crossing was safe. He would be waiting for him on the other side. There would be no armed thugs to harass him at the checkpoint. Chapter 74. Capitol Hill, Washington, D.C. Senator Daniel Wells leaned forward and studied the man on the other side of his desk.
"Did I stutter?"
he asked. "No," the director of Central Intelligence replied. "You did not."
"Was I speaking in a foreign language?"
Bob McGee rolled his eyes. He'd had it with the arrogant, condescending senator from Iowa. Let's cut the crap.
Excuse me?
You heard me.
Your agency, Director McGee, launched not one, not two, but three drone strikes inside Syria. While two of those strikes allegedly took out the social media capabilities of ISIS and killed many high-ranking ISIS members, including a handful from the Caucasus, you also downed a Russian drone and diverted DOD assets, including one drone and two stealth helicopters from the Iraq theater into Syria. How would you characterize your agency's actions?
McGee looked at him. I'd say we had a pretty damn good day.
Excuse me? The senator replied.
You heard me. Or did I stutter? Perhaps I'm speaking a foreign language. Wells was instantly enraged.
That's it. You and I are done. For over a week, I have been waiting for an in-person update from you. Now that you finally deigned to come to my office, this is how you handle yourself? I warned you what would happen if you chose to be a smartass. You're a shitty director of Central Intelligence. You and your agency are now going to pay the price. You're through. Do you understand me? It's over. You're over.
McGee waited for the man to stop bloviating. Once he had, the DCI looked at him and said,
Now, you listen to me, Dan.
The remark immediately got Wells' hackles up. He was about to shoot McGee the, how dare you, call me senator look, when McGee froze him in place with one of his own.
You and I are through, all right, the CIA director continued,
but I'm not going anywhere. You are.
What the hell are you talking about?
McGee pretended to look around.
I didn't see your chief of staff when I came in.
She has taken a couple of personal days off.
That's what you think. The FBI arrested her 2 days ago at the Hay Adams Hotel.
Wells couldn't believe it.
Rebecca was arrested? For what?
It will all be in the Washington Post tomorrow. Liliana Grace is doing the story. I believe you two know each other. At that remark, the senator went right into defense mode.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Sure you don't, Dan. Wells seethed at McGee's continued use of his first name.
Not only is your chairmanship of the Intelligence Committee at an end, McGee continued, but so is any hope you ever had of running for the White House. In fact, I'd be surprised if you could even get elected dog catcher after this is all over.
I still have no idea what you're talking about.
The director of Central Intelligence leaned back in his chair. Your chief of staff, Rebecca Ritter, is a spy for the Russians.
The senator was speechless.
A search warrant has been issued not only for her apartment, but also for your office and all of your communications together.
Wells wasn't going to go down without a fight. Collecting himself, he said the first thing that came to his mind.
You represent the Central Intelligence Agency. Under the Constitution, you have no authority to serve any warrant.
McGee smiled. You're right. I don't. But as soon as he had said the words, the intercom on the senator's phone chimed.
Senator Wells?
The secretary in the outer office intoned.
The director of the FBI is here to see you.
Epilogue. 1 month later. Boston, Massachusetts. Harvath poured two beers into a Yeti tumbler and stepped out onto his patio.
What are you doing?
Lara called from somewhere inside.
Union coffee break, he called back. 20 minutes.
Moving a chair over to the railing, he sat down. From here, he could see the Charles River below. That had been his only request. Something quiet. Near the water. The quiet part had immediately ruled out Boston Harbor. The area was fun, but too busy for his taste. When he was home, he wanted to relax. The realtor was a friend of Lara's and had found him the perfect place. It was older,
but it had character and had been well maintained. There were two bedrooms with a loft above the kitchen. The minute Lara's son Marco had seen the loft, he clambered right up the ladder and declared the space his. That was all it had taken for Harvath. He signed the lease that night. Lara had offered to fly down to Virginia and help him move, but he knew how busy she was. Besides, he needed time alone. There was a lot to think about. Yusuf, Kabani, and their families had been interviewed and processed at the U.S. Embassy in Amman. When everything was in order, they were flown to Baltimore to begin their new lives in the United States. Two Arabic-speaking families from the State Department had volunteered to help work with them and ease their transition. Yusuf had been immediately admitted to the Sidney Kimmel Comprehensive Cancer Center at Johns Hopkins. His prognosis was not good. His medical team, though, was determined, and it was quietly understood throughout the hospital that Yusuf was an important man, someone the United States thought very highly of. Everything that could be done for him would be. Harvath had flown home from Amman alone. Once Yusuf and company had made it safely across the border into Jordan, Williams had taken over. He had gotten the families into a safe house and had handled everything for them at the embassy. In the midst of that, he spent several hours talking with the Hadid brothers. They weren't his assets to run, but it was obvious that they were being underutilized in Syria. With some additional training, they could be doing much more. After some back and forth with Langley, Bob McGee and Lydia Ryan put their seal of approval on the idea. Williams was given the green light to create a new covert operations element in Syria. The Hadids would be the tip of that spear. Back on Malta, Vela continued to extract valuable information from Basayev, Rafael, and Sergun. The extent of what Russia and ISIS had been up to was chilling. As reports were fed back to President Porter, his anger, as well as his resolve, increased exponentially. In the days after Harvath returned to the United States, the word proportional was discussed a lot. It was discussed at the White House, at the State Department, at the CIA, and at the Pentagon. The other word spoken only within the president's closest circle was vengeance. It certainly lacked sophistication. It also lacked diplomatic polish. But it was accurate. The United States wanted revenge, and it would have it. Within 48 hours of returning home, Harvath was summoned to the White House. He had no idea why, until he was led downstairs to the Situation Room. Taking a seat near the president, he watched as Operation Full Justice was launched. Bombs and missiles rained down on the Russian naval installation at the Syrian port of Tartus, as well as the Haymimin airbase just to the north. The Russian air defense systems proved utterly useless against the high-tech weapons the U.S. threw at them. Ship after ship was destroyed at Tartus, as was almost every Russian aircraft at Haymimin. It was the biggest military loss one nation had suffered since World War II. Within a half hour, President Porter had gone on television to address the nation and explain the actions the United States had taken. He warned that any attempt by Russia to respond would be met with even more withering destruction. After detailing the Russians' attempt to draw America into war with ISIS in Syria, he laid out a series of non-negotiable demands. The first was that Russia withdraw from the region immediately. The second was that the nations of the Middle East must convene an immediate conference to discuss defeating terrorism by reforming Islam. In absence of any demonstrable reformation, the United States would cease to recognize the Sykes-Picot Agreement. The only nation thereunder which the United States would continue to recognize was the State of Israel. It was the region's only democracy and an example for Muslim nations to follow. In evidence of its commitment to the security of Israel, the United States would be stepping up its weapons transfers to the Jewish state, including some of its most highly advanced and sophisticated programs. Calling for unity in the days and weeks ahead, the president assured America and the world that by banding together against evil, they would ensure peace for themselves and their children. He then ended his address by quoting Edmund Burke, "When bad men combine, the good must associate, else they will fall, one by one, an unpitied sacrifice in a contemptible struggle." It was one of Porter's best speeches, and it came on the heels of several others that no president would ever want to give. The video of the horrors in Anbar, the assassination of Secretary Devin, the suicide bomber at the White House, and now a massive strike by the United States upon the Russians. All of these heaped upon the losses that have been suffered by so many already. The president prayed they were not headed to war with the Russians. He had already spoken with allies around the world, and the condemnation of Moscow had been universal. They were considered a pariah. Should they try to retaliate, it would be the end of their nation. Harvath had driven home from the White House with many of the same thoughts and concerns as the president. Fortunately, Russia did not respond. In fact, they were too involved with multiple Islamist uprisings at home. Nicholas had doctored the footage of the strikes on the ISIS meeting and had overlaid it with the voices of Russian pilots and combat controllers. It was a beautiful deception and had worked perfectly. And while the CIA tried to decide what to do with Malevsky and Eichel, McGee was also working with the Department of Justice to decide how to handle Rebecca Ritter, her Russian handler, and Joe Edwards, all of whom were cooling their heels in a high-security detention facility. Ritter was cooperating. She admitted to having done a deal with the devil. The Russians had not only paid her a fortune to spy for them, but they had also offered her the thing she wanted more than anything else. They had convinced her that they could get Senator Wells into the White House, and that from there she could have any position she wanted. For money and promised power, she had willingly sold out her country. And though McGee had his hands full with her and everything else, Harvath had suggested to him that he strike while the iron was hot and attempt to recruit Anna Strobel. He continued to feel she had all the right ingredients. The ultimate get for them, of course, would be Alexandra Ivanova. Yet again, she had been forced to see how reckless and corrupt her government was. She might be very ripe for recruitment now. McGee had told him he would take all of it under advisement and keep him up to speed on any developments. When Harvath pulled up to his home along the Potomac, it felt alien to him. It was as if it were from another time in his life, a place out of the past. In a sense, it was. He was cutting his ties with D.C. He had already sat down with Reed Carlton and explained his position. He had tendered his resignation, but the old man had refused to take it.
"Go to Boston," he told him. "Let's see what happens."
And that was that. He packed up the house, or at least those things he thought he'd need to get started. Everything else could stay behind for the time being. Stuffing his Tahoe and pulling a trailer, he made the trip to Massachusetts, grinning like an idiot almost the entire way there. For once in his life, he was happy, truly happy. He was pleased not only about where he was going and who he was with, but about what lay in front of him. He had the three ingredients to happiness right in the palm of his hand, and he knew it. Something to do, someone to love, and something to look forward to. No matter what happened, he would never look back on his life and ask what might have been if he had only made the move to Boston.
"What's this?" Lara asked, stepping out onto the patio and interrupting his thoughts.
She was wearing shorts and a t-shirt, and even so casually dressed, she was unbelievably gorgeous. He immediately thought about extending his break from 20 minutes to at least 45. He wondered if any of the neighbors could see his patio from their windows. Lara had been helping him unpack, and in her hand was a pistol suppressor.
"That?" Harvath replied. "It's a shot glass."
Lara rolled her eyes.
"And this one?" she replied, holding up another.
bud vase. I was going to pick a flower and put it in there to surprise you.
You know these are illegal in Boston, right?
Good thing I know a cop, he replied, motioning for her to come sit with him.
Setting the suppressors down, she walked over and leaned up against the edge of the railing.
You have beautiful legs for a cop, he said. You know that?
All the better to chase you with.
No way. I'm done running. You caught me, he replied, pulling her into his lap.
She brought her lips to his and kissed him, long, slow, and unbelievably sexy, just like that last kiss they had shared in Budapest. But better. That kiss told him everything he needed to know. There was no question, they were a great couple, smart, passionate, and electric. They were perfect for each other, and they had figured out a way to make it work. Slipping his hand beneath her t-shirt, he moved softly along her back until he found the clasp of her bra and popped it open.
Good timing, she whispered in his ear. I just put sheets on the bed.
Let's christen the patio first.
Lara laughed and kissed him again.
I'm really glad you're here.
So am I, he replied. So am I.
Foreign Agent was written by Brad Thor and read by Armin Schultz. Recording by Noriko Okabe. Editing by Christina Cucciano. Post-production by Hudson Sound. The associate producer was Ben Rimmelauer. Foreign Agent was produced and directed by Karen Perlman. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Foreign Agent is available in hardcover from Emily Bestler Books and Atria. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio by Brad Thor and read by Armin Schultz, Code of Conduct, Hidden Order, and Full Black.